You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Oh, I need a little bit more than that. You've had about 5 cups of coffee before you got here. So I'll say it one more time. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. I'm so happy to actually see everybody here once again at Brookings. I know that we have some of you who are new to a Brookings session. I won't ask you to raise your hand, but I would say welcome to you. And I know we've got some repeat visitors that come to many Brookings sessions, so I would say welcome back. I don't know the last time that you were here, and I actually don't know if you were here last week for a privacy conversation, but if you were, you're going to get a little bit more privacy today. I'm excited for this particular conversation for a variety of reasons. How many of you have heard that we are trying to pass federal privacy legislation in the United States? How many of you heard that about a year ago? How many of you heard about 6 months ago? And you're going to hear about today. And I say that because despite all of the perfect storm that sort of converged when privacy legislation was actually, you know, restarted, we're still at this place where we haven't come up with what we think is really good comprehensive privacy legislation. And in my role, and I'm going to introduce the panelists, I'm Nicole Turner-Lee. I work in the Center for Technology Innovation as a fellow. And I basically have 3 buckets of work that I actually spend a lot of my time on. The first one is around regulatory and legislative policy. I see some friends out here. I've been doing this for quite some time. In fact, I'm not going to date myself because I have this young hairstyle, so I'm trying to look like my daughter. But when we started talking about privacy in the Obama administration, maybe back in 2008, 2009, many of us were in that conversation. My colleague Cam Carey, who was at Commerce at the time, brought many of us together to talk about online consumer privacy. Back then, when we were just dealing with the Internet of Things, and some of you may remember that. I also work on issues related to the digital divide. And yes, I'm going to give a shameless plug. I have a book coming out next year on the U.S. digital divide, and I've completed a 7-city tour of the United States on how people are accessing digital resources. So that will come out soon. And then finally, I work on issues related to artificial intelligence, particularly algorithmic bias. So that ties into the privacy conversation, and we'll see how long we have. I got a feisty group, just wait, in terms of the discussion. If we get there in terms of other spokes that are under the privacy umbrella, we'll talk about that. So why did I decide I want to have this? Outside of being somebody who focuses in that first bucket, there have been a lot of privacy conversations going on. And in those conversations, we edge 1 inch closer, as all of us showed by raising our hand, and 1 inch backwards. And so what I'm really interested in, and I think the panelists up here will help us glean this out and unpack this a little bit, is one, why we haven't made a lot of progress in the last 6 months. And then two, when we look at federal privacy legislation as this umbrella, what are the spokes that are sort of being debated right now? So all of us have really talked about the principles. Cam, Carey, and I sort of have tag-teamed on this in terms of the need for some either comprehensive or baseline or whatever you want to call it in terms of the framework. But then if you think about an umbrella, there are these little pieces that keep the umbrella solid. And under that may be some of the issues that we'll talk about today, which are cloud computing applications, healthcare applications, et cetera. But we got to unpack why we even have not even opened the umbrella wide enough to figure out how to get the type of bipartisan support. So with me today are 3 folks that I consider to be just wonderful people generally. I've known them for most of my life here in D.C., but also they got something to say, and I want them to share it from the Brookings stage. So I'm going to start at the bottom. She's not an unfamiliar face here at Brookings, and she's got a new job. Amy Simonic is now the executive director at Silicone Flatirons, where she is a nationally recognized expert before then and now in domestic surveillance, cybersecurity, and privacy law. Before that, she was the U.S. Policy Manager and Global Policy Counsel at Access Now, and now in Boulder, where she has a much better view than those of us in D.C. You know, I had to ask her. Look how relaxed she looks compared to all of us, right? She's actually moving that forward in terms of privacy, and we'll hear more about her in this new role in a few minutes. Let's give her a round of applause. Morgan is another friend, and he's somebody that I used to see often at the oil change place. Yep. Because of live in the same neighborhood, is the president of the App Association, where he represents more than 5,000 app makers and connected devices in the mobile economy. He leads the organization's advocacy and strategy on behalf of small to medium-sized businesses on policy issues such as privacy, intellectual property, competition, and small business innovation. Let's give him a round of applause. And Jamie, and we've actually had the opportunity to sit on a panel together as well, another friend. She began her career at CTA as Director of Government Affairs in 2014 and was promoted to Senior Director in 2017. Her current scope includes policy expertise on self-driving vehicles, transportation innovation, and privacy. And before that, she served in the Washington, D.C. office of Representative Bill Schuster, representative from Pennsylvania, and the then chairman of the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee. Let's give her a round of applause. David Young, there's a seat for you up here. Call him out since we have no ushers. It's not like church. So let me jump into this first question.
What church?
I told you they're a feisty group, starting with myself, okay? So, yeah, right, no collection. We will not have a collection played at Brookings. So let me start this first question with this panel. Why has this dialogue sort of been extended? I mean, since I think many people in this room probably heard about the need for privacy legislation following the perfect storm of Cambridge Analytica, right? But prior to that, there's been discussions. But why has it been so long? And really, for this audience who is probably following this, how has the debate changed over the last 6 months? You know, what are the stakes now compared to 6 months ago? Amy, why don't we start with you? And let people know again a little bit more about your organization.
Sure. So 6 months ago, I was actually still in D.C. Working on the privacy legislation conversations. That changed about 3 months ago. I moved to Boulder, Colorado, and took over Silicon Flatirons, which is, I'm going to be a little bit biased here, probably one of the preeminent tech think tanks at a law school in the country. We work on tech policy convenings, student development, and entrepreneurship outreach. And so I have been leading some of the work that we've been doing outside of Silicon Flatirons. But previous to that, I was deeply involved in some of the conversations that are happening in D.C. around privacy. And if I were to answer Nicole's question about why that has stalled out, I think one of the reasons is we never got a vehicle. People were waiting for, there were so many laws, I can count on two hands the number of privacy proposals or bills or principles that I saw. But there was this promise of a bipartisan draft law that everybody thought was going to be the one that everybody kind of bought into and tried to make better and was going to move forward. And we never got the language on that. And I think one of the reasons for that is people, the privacy issue continues to evolve. The CCPA is now concrete.
Yep, and for those of you, that's the California Privacy Act.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pending.
The California Consumer Privacy Act is kind of moving into implementation at the beginning of next year. The news stories around privacy keep coming out, and people keep realizing that it impacts different communities and different categories of people in different ways. And every time that story develops, a new member of Congress decides that they have to be involved in these conversations and be included in the room, which means you have to wrap in their staff and get them up to speed and get them to buy into what's being produced. And that takes a lot of time. I will say, I don't think it's a bad thing that we're at this point. It means that we're listening to more people. We're taking in more perspectives. It does mean that people may not be happy with the fact that the California law is going to go into effect. But again, I personally don't think that's a bad thing. Having more protections, having companies look into how to apply those protections in the United States. So I think the conversation continues to move. People continue to show that they are interested and involved. And we will eventually see a federal privacy law. Is it going to be next year in an election year?
Right.
Probably not, but the it's to be continued. It's not stopped.
Yeah. Morgan, let me run to you and ask you that question.
So I think one of the fascinating parts, you said 6 months, but I see Aaron Burstein sitting here in the audience, and I remember when he was 10 years ago, working on the Green Paper, which was a comprehensive privacy legislation, and then you ended up at the FTC for a while. again, pushing comprehensive privacy legislation. And there's a well-known think tank slash advocacy group here in D.C. where I think they must have had a swear jar in their office that you put money in every time you didn't mention the word comprehensive privacy legislation. And I think we all know which group I'm talking about, three letters. So it's not as though this topic hasn't been at the forefront for more than a decade. A lot of the underlying problem comes down to what happens in most of these cases, that depending on how the language is crafted, there will be winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And so there is a sense that legislation that puts its thumb on one side of the scale or the other is going to meet fierce opposition. Amy was mentioning something that we've all lived through, where you get close to a draft and then somebody comes into the room at the last minute, and she can tell that story better than I can later, but it comes in the last minute and says, oh, I just have three words. And, you know. And the reality is with comprehensive privacy legislation, I think we all have to be clear-eyed about that reality. I think the reason you said the 6 months is I think consumers are becoming a bit more clear-eyed about the value of their information and where they sit in the marketplace. And I think that with the GDPR, that's the European version of comprehensive privacy legislation, with California, with the attempt in Washington State with facial recognition, I think it's the consumer now that is in a different position. And I think before I hand it over, I think one of the last parts is, for the first time, we are now seeing market competition around privacy. I don't think anyone can deny that Apple has made a decision to market on privacy. Their CEO has sent letters. They've put that statement out there that we're betting our purchasers of our products want this message. So I'd say, one, winners and losers are going to make some decisions different. Two, I think the consumers have a better sense of the value of their product. And three, I think you see companies making an active decision to speak to consumers about their privacy and why it has value. And so I think that's why the conversation is changing, and we'll get to a little bit more on CCPA afterwards, but yep. That's what I'd go with.
Jamie, what do you think?
Sure, yeah. Morgan and Amy both made really, really good points that I definitely agree with. Last year we started really having this conversation on why we needed federal privacy legislation between GDPR and then CCPA moving. There was a lot of pressure, and a lot of pressure not just from consumers but also from industry for that clarity at the federal level. You know, it comes to an election, you have a flip in the House, you have a lot of new staff, you have and Senate Commerce, you have a new chairman and a new ranking member, all staff that needs to get engaged in the conversation. In the House, you have a flip and all of the leadership, and you have to wait for people to get staffed up. Mm-hmm. So, that takes 6 months just to get people caught up and making sure that they're having all of the right meetings with the right people and getting that input. But I think another thing that has happened is that we've seen in the last couple of months, there's been this pushback on tech in general. Looking at liability with Section 230 and now antitrust and competition, I think privacy is maybe getting a little bit lost in that shuffle where we have all these really big topics and big issues all relating to tech. And while I argue a lot of them have to do with a lot more than just tech, and especially privacy impacts a lot more than just tech companies, I think a lot of those things are getting kind of conflated, and it just gets messier, especially when you have a lot of committees with overlapping or fighting over jurisdiction of who gets to do what. And who needs to be in the room when, it gets very messy. I think it makes it harder.
Yeah, I want to actually stay on that for just a second, if you don't mind, and maybe get some reaction from Morgan and Amy. I mean, are we seeing like this blurred line or this fuzziness now? Because it does appear like in the last 6 months, there has been a lot of press towards, big tech shakeup, and these the presidential campaigns have sort of made it their business, interestingly enough, to not necessarily just take privacy, but take a whole range of tech issues and sort of put them in the same bucket. How do we sort of untease out of that or unpack out of those discussions that privacy is still pretty important?
Yes. Let me start.
So, you need this probably to start. Right?
Well, no,
I get to play cleanups.
Collaboration.
So I think one of the problems is, and I think it's a bit of laziness, we tend to lump tech into one phrase. But the reality is that retail is tech. In fact, we'll talk about it on CCPA a little bit. I mean, retail has affinity cards, and they have a huge quantity of data. And so retail is tech. And there's this interesting divide. There's a tendency to lump Facebook, Google, Apple, all of them together. But it was interesting on the I testified before the House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on Antitrust, and we were all on the panel. It was Amazon and Apple and Facebook and Google, and I was there, and Tim Wu, and we all went down the line. It was funny. By the end of the hearing, it was Congressman Armstrong who was like, "Oh, Apple, yeah, we'll ask you some questions, but you haven't been really part of the discussion," because they were focused on some of these privacy questions that were coming up. And it was interesting how what was happening as they were asking these privacy questions, they were asking questions about, well, what are you doing with data?
Right.
And the Apple person was like, well, we don't really use it. And then, you know, other person, that, so each person kind of had their own niche. So I think one of it is there's a tendency to lump everybody together.
Yep.
And I think that's a mistake. That's a mistake in terms of how we talk about it. And two, I think that to tease it out gets to the key factor, which is, look, we're talking about your information and your personal assessment of what its value is, both to you and in the marketplace. What are you willing to provide to somebody who collects data in exchange for a service?
That's right.
And I think that's the tease out. Are you good with that exchange?
Mm-hmm.
And then I know you deal with this too, which is, do you think people understand what that exchange is? Do privacy policies even, you were talking about earlier about reading them, I don't know that privacy policies are the methodology to get to help people understand that exchange sometimes.
I mean, I think privacy policies have been written over time in a way that takes the power away from people being able to understand.
Right.
I think that we could get there, and there's been a lot of particularly academic conversations about what a privacy policy needs to entail and when it needs to be shown. And,
right.
But I don't think that they're written now in a way that allow people to have any idea what information they're turning over, what it can be used for, how long it's going to be held. It's just, as a sophisticated user of technology, I have no idea half the time. So people who don't spend their days, their day jobs reading privacy policies, I have no hope for. And it's not on their fault.
Right.
It just is that everything is stacked against them. To your point, though, I think a lot of these conversations stem from common feelings.
Yeah.
I've been manipulated. I've been abused. I have had my either information or interacted with a company or store or platform that has taken advantage of me. And so all of these tech conversations kind of stem out of common feelings. And maybe we do need to separate them back out. But in a way, this is going to be a very unpopular point of view. This is like a slate pitch. We maybe need to bring them together a little bit because there's a little bit of the solution in each of these conversations toward the overall issue of manipulation on the internet. And once we start pulling that in, like when you talk about the quote-unquote fake news or misinformation situation, that's a societal problem. It's not really a tech problem. And so we have to kind of pull out and think, what are the little things that we can do that move us forward across the space? Now, those each have their own incredibly nuanced conversations, but pulling out might actually help a little bit in this.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I've been using this analogy of the umbrella with the spokes, right? Because I think part of what's happened in this conversation for me in the last 6 months is that the spokes are becoming more defined. And since there are so many of them, everybody's sort of pitching in what they think this spoke should be on it. And it's gone beyond the traditional conversations we've had about consent frameworks and, you know, data minimization. It's gone to bias and discrimination and this and that. But I do have a question because none of you have actually said it in the first 10 minutes of this panel, which is the word preemption. And so I'm curious to see if that conversation has gotten better or worse in the last 6 months before we go into some more details on how we actually get to some type of federal privacy legislation.
I don't know that it's moved a whole lot. I think that, you know, everyone's kind of got their kind of in their corners, as we were talking about earlier, on the preemption question. I think this just happens. It's not unique to privacy. It happens in
everything,
a lot of
right.
pretty much everything. Give me an issue that, and yeah, find some way to relate preemption to it. But we're now looking at California, right? And they've just closed out their legislative session. We'll start to see, you know, what the AG does with it, and then next year what implementation looks like. I think that makes this whole conversation harder that we've gotten so far down the road with California by itself, because you've got, you know, just looking at the politics of it, you've got the Speaker of the House, California, you've got a huge delegation from California, primarily,
yep.
that you know, our Democrats and generally will want to support their state and their state's law. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile that in the House?
Yep.
And get it something through the House that preempts California but doesn't in a way?
Right.
And then that same thing then get through a Republican Senate. I think the politics on that are really hard. So, you know, we were just discussing how do you move toward each other on the preemption question? And I don't know how you do that without us seeing something to react to on paper.
Yeah,
to get people to come to the table.
One more reaction to this, because we've got 20-plus states.
There. Sure. So for those of you who don't know, and this is D.C., I'm not going to forget that I'm back in D.C., but preemption is the conversation around the degree of federal law is going to write over state law. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it's really unhelpful that people have kind of gone into their corners is because broad preemption, which a lot of people say, like, we just need preemption, we need to preempt all these state laws, could impact so much broader than the CCPA. Mm-hmm. It could go after civil rights law, it could go after abortion law, it could go after anything that kind of comes into the realm of privacy. And so even the people who I think really want broad preemption don't necessarily want the broadest of preemption. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you could have no preemption at all, which could allow people to pass laws that conflict outright at the state and the federal level. So even on this side, nobody goes all the way to the end. I think they at least want basic conflict preemption. They want a federal law that, to the extent that it conflicts with state law,
right.
one standard will take over. And then between those two layers, there are 50,000 other options, and nobody has dug in to figure out where they need to be. And we were talking, you've heard many allusions. We had a really in-depth conversation about preemption before we came out here.
I know. I was like, please save some of this for the panel.
But unless we start talking about what real problems preemption is needed to solve and have really honest conversations, that conversation won't go any further. And getting back to my first point, that won't probably happen until we have a vehicle with actual language that allows people to dig into those issues and feel like they're not giving up on their position. Mm-hmm. And until then, it's going to be hardcore digging into the ground and just waiting to see what happens.
Right. But I mean, I got to just, as you answer, Morgan, I mean, we knew about California before California became California. We knew this law was coming. And I think I had a coin toss with some friends from the EU who talked about it. They said, do you think we're going to have federal privacy legislation before California? I thought I was going to win, but I'm not, right? clearly. So.
Yeah, I always have to remember that nobody does anything until basically, you know, you're waking up and looking at the rope in the morning, right? It's that kind of instinct that lives in D.C. of, oh, well, no, we'll put it off, we'll put it off, put it off. I think, though, there are two things. One of the things that came out of GDPR that still to this day is a bit of a problem, and CCPA, and one of the reasons why preemption is important is even when there's areas that aren't true conflict, you can have overlapping requirements or overlapping build-outs. And those favor larger institutions with larger collections of lawyers. Mm. When you have a conversation, you know, working in the health space, which is right. what a lot of what I do on the health privacy space, it's very easy for large institutions to say, well, first you need to do a DPO, and then you need to have all of this documentation on how you're doing privacy by design on your health product, and then you need to do a complete 6-month survey of your data handling on health records. And mind you, this is before you've ever stricken a single line of code, before you've written any part of your product. Your first hire is not a programmer, it's a lawyer. And that works in a large institution where maybe your health product is a skunkworks project and you're borrowing from you're going to go to your general counsel and say, hey, I need an FTE to work on this. But you're if a 5-man startup who's making a product that, say, figures out a way to solve diabetic retinopathy, you've probably got 5 MD PhDs focused on the problem and their first hire is not a doctor. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, the preemption question is not strictly about all, you know, shoveling off liability risk, which I think some people do. They use preemption to push that off. But it's also, even when the law isn't truly conflicting, where it creates multiple requirements, I often find that my larger company friends are much more comfortable with that than my smaller company members who start to say, hold on, mm-hmm. what all do I have to do? Mm-hmm. So I think Amy's point about everybody coming to the table, and I think there's probably two elements to this. We've talked preemption. The other one is private right of action.
Yep.
And those two things are the anchor points of this fight where I don't think you're going to have a lot of people coming to the table. We talked about this earlier, all of us, about the fact that we all know in D.C. one of the things that happens is you don't want to give something up that you might want to give up later in the negotiation process. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So preemption and private right of action are the ace cards, the whatever you call it, the card that you're holding on to that you're not going to be Trump card, really, huh?
Yeah. He said he wasn't going to say it. Yeah, right.
The Trump card in this situation that people are holding on to. So Amy is completely right that there are...
Somebody get that on the record.
There are multiple senators in specific and some members of Congress, and as you said, I think you hit the nail on the head where you said jurisdictional fights between energy and commerce and judiciary exist, but there's also preemption and private right of action, which unless we can find a way to come to the table on that, there is going to continue to be a problem. And I'll go back to one of my original points. As much as I love tech and am from tech, I think retail will be driving a whole lot of this.
Well, I definitely hear Brookings have seen more non-tech companies sort of step in the debate, because what company is not tech?
And everybody's
part
tech.
Of the issue. I want to, because I always want to be mindful of people in terms of how far they are and deeper they are in the debate. Private right of action, explain that to people, Morgan.
Basically, can you hire an attorney to sue on your behalf?
Yep.
And to sue a specific company on your behalf.
Right.
So not the Attorney General, not the Federal Trade Commission, not a state agency, but you hire an attorney and go sue somebody.
That's right. And so, Jamie, you know, sort of chiming you in there into this conversation. So what should we expect, though, as the new normal when CCPA actually gets passed? Mm-hmm. What's going to be our new scenarios? I mean, we're going to see more right to legal action by individuals, even if it's a person who wasn't even directly harmed by it. Are we going to see California sort of be the framing point for what federal privacy legislation should look like? Or are we going to just play out California with hopes that, you know, at some point, something will happen, but we don't know what and when.
Mm-hmm. I think it depends. It depends on, you know, the size of your company. I mean, if you're a big player in California, you're going to focus there and you're going to try and figure out how you comply with it. Because I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions there. There are still a lot of things that were left on the table. We've mentioned retail a few times. The loyalty programs mm-hmm. issue has still not been
That's
solved.
Right.
That's been delayed until next year. We still need to see regs from the AG. So the next couple months, really, and into next year, I think are going to be dominated by reacting to California and figuring out how to deal with it. And then you also have GDPR. I mean, a lot of these companies that are big in California are also big internationally and are working to comply with GDPR. I mean, the ones that are big enough to have it be worth it. I think, you know, I was reading the other day, there are 1,000 different U.S. news sources that have just stopped operating in Europe because it's too uncertain and it costs too much to comply or to try to comply with GDPR.
Right.
So reacting to those two things, and then, you know, if we have a bill to react to, maybe we'll bring us back to the federal stage. But right now, the feds aren't saying anything, so we're getting kind of pushed out of the conversation.
I do want to make one point, though, that you made. You said big. One of the problems with data is big is not what you think it is.
Right.
A good example is one of our members did the first sideways keyboard on the iPhone. He has 2.8 million users. He's one guy in Oregon, and he wrote an app. We've got another guy who does Montessori apps for kids. Montessori apps. He's got 1.5 million users on multiple products. And so big is not big. When it comes to data sets.
Yeah.
My guys who are in the IoT space, they will have literally billions of data points that they have in their collection, and they can be a five-man shop.
Yeah.
So that's why you have to watch out on big, because, as you know, big is about the data set, not necessarily about the company.
Yeah. Did you want to say something, Amy?
It's also about the sensitivity. And going back specifically the health sector, I mean, I think there are definitely going to be places where people are okay saying, maybe I don't want somebody rushing to the market to try to collect 2.5 billion data sets before they've thought through these issues. Mm-hmm. And I think some of this is a growing pains issue for the smaller companies. We are at, and had we had privacy legislation in this country or like GDPR-style legislation 10 years ago, we'd have gone through this already.
Right, right.
There would have been a pain point. We would have figured it out. Third parties, largely, I think, are going to come in and do a lot of this the same way they do with employee records and paychecks and other things. And we'd have a system in place. We are using the promise of an inevitable pain point when a law passes to keep a law from getting passed. And that means we're never going to get through that, which means we're actually creating larger pain points down the road when there are more companies who can do more things, who are further entrenched in a system that doesn't have a federal privacy law. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we do it now, it's lesser. If we did it 10 years ago, it would have been even
easier. Right, that's right.
And so we keep pushing it back and making it harder, I think, on ourselves.
Yeah, and I mean, this brings up, and I think you saw, for those of you that are here, you saw sort of embedded in this conversation is, again, the broader dialogue around process implementation. We really haven't gotten into enforcement, but I think we've actually talked about enforcement a lot in the general public, right? But I am curious, as we look at these verticals of healthcare or cloud-based applications and other software, you know, how do we think, you know, privacy legislation will actually impact, I think, Morgan, going back to what you talked about, companies that are small and medium size, startups, you know, where do we see that conversation happening as we sort of look at, you know, device makers and others mm-hmm. who are in this space, either directly or indirectly?
So both the App Association and CTA have been working on some of these questions in this space. One of the hard parts in working on digital medicine and digital health is sometimes de-identified information is not good. What I mean by that is to solve the problem. Here's the construct. When you see a physician in your life, if you see your physician at what you consider the top of their game, they will have seen about 29,000 patients, give or take. But the number of patients that they will have seen with your comorbidity, your genotype, your genetic makeup, your age, your family history, your everything else, you're lucky if you have a physician that's seen 100 mm-hmm. people with your exact makeup. And so that puts the physician in the unenviable position of having to make a decision about your treatment based on what they remember from medical school, a couple of classes that they've attended, and 100 data points. Mm-hmm. Now, there's none of you in this room who do business and make life or death decisions on 100 data points over that kind of stretch. So one of the things that digital medicine has the promise to do by using large data sets is to start to say, oh, women of Irish descent tend to react better to this. Or if the person has this disease and this comorbidity, we actually find this medication treats them better. Mm-hmm. My wife, who is a doctor but of another type, she now works on epidemiology issues, she's always ripe to point out to me that most of the medical medicine testing has been done on men. Yes. Even when these women, even though the medication is assigned to women. And my wife is like, why is this medication being offered up without the concomitant research? And so large data sets in some of these cases where we have very personal, very direct information is the only way we'll discover it. And to your point, that's why we would agree. When it comes to health information, we need to be thoughtful about how we move forward. The real question is going to be is what's considered health information?
Right. And what's considered personal?
Well, right. Health, like, what you eat, where you live, starts to be the thing. It's less about treating the diseases that we know. It's about finding the solutions to the diseases that we don't have an answer for yet.
Mm-hmm. But medical testing is...
Yeah.
Privacy law will not impact who they test the medicines
right. Morgan,
on.
You've been outnumbered
actually,
on this panel.
All that? Are we moving forward with gigantic potential privacy invasions if the actual underlying practices that have nothing to do with privacy, like who is actually included in these medical tests, we can't solve for. Let's get that stuff out of the way.
Actually, that's the part that's cool. The FDA and Bakul Patel at the FDA and others are working on pre-certification programs and others so that we can actually do more with large data sets. The FDA, I'm here to actually say great things about a government agency. The FDA is actually putting a lot of effort into exactly that question, which is how do we pull larger data sets in? They've got a whole AI project around this, and a lot of it is public pressure. And I would encourage people mm-hmm. to write, you know, to encourage them to put pressure on the FDA and your members of Congress, because there is the thought inside of the FDA, which is, how do we get more information? And if you sit down with like CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and they have CMMI, which does the research in this space, CMMI, we went to go meet with them. They say to get a research project out of CMMI will take 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, 10 years ago, we didn't even have smartphones. Right. So unlocking some of these data sets will actually be key to empowering the FDA and companies to make good applications and to show the effectiveness. So it overlaps, and I'm hopeful that we can solve the problem you're outlining by giving them better data, because that's part of the problem. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I mean, I think
I
both
mean
of
to
you
jump
are,
on that one.
Yeah,
it's
right.
My
no,
favorite
both
topic.
Of you are right. I mean, Amy, I share a similar piece with algorithms, you know, where we're actually looking at training data sets that are, you know, large email. But I don't want to go there. That's another event, okay? We had an event like that a couple months ago. I'm not going to go down that alley again. But I do want to talk a little bit about, though, go back into these nuanced verticals, right?
Right.
Where having access to personal information will matter. I'm not sure to the extent of how much that information has to be personally identifiable, but there may be cases, particularly the cases of people of color, where you want to know what some of those genetic markers are so that you actually have better access to solutions. And if they're underrepresented, that's a problem on the bat. But, you know, I'm always curious, as we go down this road of privacy legislation, are we going to forget how to nuance that? One, from the big company that may be providing that service, like an Apple, where you can get a lot of health data. But then two, from smaller companies that are heavily relying on the big companies for data flows. Exactly. So I'm just curious, you know, I'll go, Jamie, to you. I mean, CTA, this is part of your business, right? Empowering these new innovations.
Absolutely.
To what extent should we be jumping into that conversation on how privacy law will affect these third areas or these third ways, yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think health and wellness devices is an area that, you know, we've had a couple of years now. But it's been an area of huge growth and innovation in how you can use these different tools. You could use how you can use virtual reality to help with health monitoring and how you can help deal with therapies, or how you can use different trackers to help look for certain markers that may, you know, indicate that, hey, like, your blood pressure is way higher than it normally is. Maybe you should call the doctor. You should go to the doctor. And building those in the first place, yeah, it requires data. You have to know what you're building toward. And how you define, because you've mentioned personal information and you've mentioned private information or sensitive information. Definitions in this debate are so important.
Yep.
Half of the amendments that just went through on CCPA were all about the definition of personal information, and you know what are exemptions, what is personal, what isn't, what is sensitive or risky, what isn't. And I think we're missing a little bit from this conversation is how that impacts harm, like what is the harm to consumers, and you know, how do you draw that line? Is something always sensitive? Is geolocation data always sensitive? Mm-hmm. X, Y, or Z, is it always sensitive? And do you always treat it the same way, or does it depend on the application? And I think that that's a question that still kind of remains to be answered, and we've started to dig into the weeds more on that just with California, but I think that we'd be remiss to forget that.
Yeah, Amy, I know you want to jump in on this one.
I think the other side is what's never sensitive.
Right.
Oftentimes you hear name, phone number, address. There are things that are given as like not sensitive information, but you start putting those into databases together and then adding other things that you might think are not sensitive, and you start painting a really full sensitive picture of somebody's life based solely on publicly available data. Mm-hmm. And in an era of machine learning, that distinction just becomes almost nonsensical. 8 years ago, there was a machine learning paper that said with two location points, you can identify somebody exactly who they are, just two random location points. We're getting better and better at figuring out sensitive information from what many might consider non-sensitive. And I would say like this distinction is actually becoming less meaningful over time, because all of that information going into a common center and being analyzed means we probably know more about people than people know about themselves.
But Morgan, before you jump in, so this is interesting. I was at a conference on last week, for NSF was actually hosting this. And it was interesting. We were talking about location data. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple years ago, we would have had this conversation on location data. We were all up in arms around that in terms of our privacy. Today, you apply that to certain applications, and we're mad if they don't know where we're at, because there are several applications that rely upon that location data, whether it's a navigation system, it's a ride-sharing service, it's something. You know, are we, and I'll just throw this out as a question. I don't think I've asked this question to any panel. Are we sort of over analyzing what consumers need and want versus what they're using? You see what I mean? Like in this privacy discussion that's pretty much caught up by us, are we forgetting that some of these things consumers actually want their data used for? Yeah.
But so this is the Uber question. A few years ago, it turned out there were three options at that point in time for an app to collect your location data on the iPhone. There was Always, Never, and While Using the App. And people were selecting while using the app, and they were getting information after they closed the app. So they were able to go a little bit further. And people were really not happy with that. Yes, they might want you to have their location information at certain points in time. Few people want every app tracking their location all of the time or beyond where they think they can track you. And so we need to be able to approach it in that, again, back to the nuance of what do people want, and are you giving them the option? I want to be able to enter my address sometimes into a place and not have the app know where I am. Do I have the option to do that? In some cases, that's not true.
Right.
In some cases, it is. Why can't people make that decision for themselves? And if they do want it, then they have the option of turning it on.
I think the problem, and again, Amy's 100% right. There you go. Second time.
on video.
On video. I think the problem.
Three times and the panel explodes.
I think the problem is that, and this is something that's very sensitive to my community, it's the whole kind of the third-party use question and where we go, because as you say, do consumers really, do they really want it used? And to Amy's point, they want it used in the way that they have the expectation of it. And for those of you who know Lori Kraner, who is at the FTC, has written a lot about, do people actually have that fulsome knowledge of not what the immediate use is, but what happens next, and what happens after that, and what happens after that? And that's where, as Amy pointed out, you get these vertical silos of data built, and that creates trouble. The flip side of it is my community depends on third-party tool sets to do a lot of things.
Right.
Third-party analytics are a big part of how a smaller company can compete with bigger companies, because it ties you into things, it gives you access to a lot of other information. And kind of the bogeyman in the room on all of this is interest-based advertising, because that drives a lot of the conversation that may be separate and apart from what the expectation is. As you said, right, if somebody says, I only want it on when I'm using the app, but the app monetizes through interest-based advertising, well, then the app company says, this gets back to who's the customer, right? Mm-hmm. If it's monetized through advertising, you're not really the customer.
Right.
So from the app's perspective, they need that information. And so their attitude is, well, no, I need that, because otherwise I can't provide you the service you want. Mm-hmm. And to your point is, this is that question about where consumers sit, right? How much convenience do they want for a free application that's monetized through the use of their data? And then do they really know what all of those things are? And that's, I think, where we as an industry have still not succeeded.
Yeah.
And that is helping them to understand all of those uses.
Yeah, from a layperson's perspective, and particularly when I've done this book tour and asked people about privacy, I think it's this concern of consumers that we've become the product, right? Yeah. And not having a control over what does that actually mean, as you talked about before. But I think going back to the first conversation of why we're still here is because representatives are trying to take that consumer experience and figure out ways to make that into legislation where they can actually have bipartisan support. And everybody has a different angle and where they're coming into the conversation.
Yeah, and if I can just add to that, I think that, you know, obviously transparency and choice are important and key, and we should be considering that. But
that's right.
We need to think about, too, is the cases when it's not clear whose data it really is. Facebook put out an interesting picture or a paper last week. It was focused on data portability. And started to lay out some of the more in-depth questions of how we deal with data portability and what it is what it means. Mm-hmm. And I thought one of the most interesting questions was, whose data is it? If you want to, if you know, I have my contacts in a service, and I want to move that to another service, mm-hmm. is it just my data that is, or is it the people that it's their contact information?
Right.
Do they need? Have they already, you know, given approval for me to do whatever I want with the data once I have it in there in the first place, or not? And whose responsibility is that? So there's really interesting edge cases that I think we'll start to see more of as we see, as we get further into the implementation of California, that are hard to think right off the bat when you're trying to legislate on it, but then come up later as, oh, that's a really good point. I actually don't know the answer to that. And what does that mean?
What are you showing us, Morgan?
When GDPR first came out, one of the questions we asked is, if I hand you my business card, does that equal consent?
Well,
does she now have... Yeah,
there
we go. In other words, this question is...
Give it to Nicole.
Right, and exactly. So the physical business cards, because GDPR doesn't just cover the digital, you know, the email transaction or anything like that. It's a physical business card. And the question that we asked various DPAs and others were, if I hand over a business card, is that, does that mean I'm assenting to them taking my information and putting it into my contacts? And then if that contacts is a service, does that mean I can go to LinkedIn mm-hmm. and pull my data out even if I, because I don't want you to have it, even though I gave you a business card, mm-hmm. which most people would say is consent. So it's fascinating to think about, even in physical space, how that will end up being represented.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, these are conversations we can have and solve for.
That's right.
We know these are going to be problems. Why aren't we digging into conversation at that level of nuance? Before I left, we were talking about what types of data should somebody be able to access when they exercise their right to access, which is one of the rights under the GDPR. It's something that you see in CCPA. Should you be able to access the information you've given, the information that's analyzed and determined about you from what you've got, like what levels? Mm-hmm. It's going to be the same questions when you ask to erase information that's mm-hmm. owned, when you ask to port. Where do those rights apply? These are predictable, knowable questions that are going to have to be solved by legislation and things that we can talk about right now and figure out what the answers are to make sure that they not only work and are workable, but work 10 years in the future. Because let's face it, if we do get a federal law, it'll be at least 10 years before we're talking about this again, if ever. Thanks to California, we're having this conversation to begin with. Let's not forget that when we decide to have really broad preemption, that a state is the reason that this federal conversation has started happening.
Right. I'm going to go to questions in a few minutes. So if you have a question that is percolating in your mind, just write it down. But we will have some time for question and answer. Before I kind of give you all this chair of giving us a solution, I do want to bring in one other area, which is cybersecurity, right? Oftentimes, we're in privacy conversations, and just like that smoke analogy, cybersecurity either comes up or doesn't come up, or it's the top of the umbrella, right, in terms of the reason why we're having these conversations in the first place. Some legislators are sort of driving their involvement based on the cybersecurity aspect of it mm-hmm. Versus, you know, just the general consumer privacy rights. Where do you think we're going to actually fall out with regards to the cyber conversation moving forward?
I think we will likely see security as an aspect of privacy law. It'll probably say something along the lines of companies should implement reasonable security practices.
Right.
Dear agency, figure out what that means. Mm-hmm. But the FTC's authority in this area has been gutted recently because of a lawsuit challenging one of their actions. So we need to have some indication back. And I think some of the questions in security and some of the questions in privacy, we're going to start to see overlap. We know, and I talk about this on security panels, rarely on privacy panels, we know what to do if our credit card information gets breached. Like, how many of you have gotten notice that your credit card information was breached?
How many multiple times?
Yeah. You get your identity fraud protection probably from the company that had it stolen. You change your credit card number. It's really inconvenient for about 3 months because all of those auto pays that you had set up have to be reset up again. But you know how to figure it out.
Yep.
If your photos on your phone got hacked into, nobody really knows from a personal operational matter what to do. Mm-hmm. How do you even respond to more personal information getting breached? And we're going to have to figure out that from a privacy perspective as well. How do people connect to this non-financial information? What is the harm that derives from that? And those are really hard conversations because a lot of that is emotional, mental, long-term, unable to come back from it, emotional and mental. But it's not the I have $5 stolen from my bank account or $5,000 or $5
million. That's right. Uh-huh. And well, I was going to bring up something, but go ahead. You might say it.
Maureen Olhausen has done some work on this, and Paula Bruning, who many of you know, is also somebody looking at this exact question on those of you who are in the legal sphere, you've heard harms theory and this question of how does the FTC take action. Mm-hmm. And so it's been very interesting to see, you know, both of those are former FTC people mm-hmm. with inside knowledge of how it works, and how do you construct something that creates a harms framework when you don't have direct monetary harm. I think the other part, though, which is important is, and you touched a bit on this, on the control idea, is part of giving people back some authority over their data is making sure that it is theirs and that they have some sense of how it's controlled. So we are fierce advocates for encryption,
end encryption.
Right. I mean, I think all of that stuff is super critical to providing some sense of self, some sense of ownership, because it also makes a clearer pathway for breaches.
Yep.
Because if it's encrypted and it's something that I don't have permit, I haven't given the holder of that, the person who's holding that container, and I haven't given them permission to access, then if there's a data breach on their end and it's encrypted, then my risk is less.
Yeah.
So I think there is a tendency for people to, because back to privacy, the number one thing that people, when we do focus groups on privacy, what they're really afraid about is identity theft.
Yeah.
It's weird, but when you ask people about privacy, what are you concerned about of privacy? Well, I'm afraid my data is going to be stolen. And then you have to be like, that's actually identity theft. We're talking about privacy. And I don't think the general consumer feels that those are as separated as those of us who are in the debate do.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I agree with that 100%. I think there's a lot of confusion on the part of consumers on what is security or cybersecurity versus what is privacy. And they do get mixed in mm-hmm. together. I don't think there will be a large security component to a privacy mm-hmm. bill, more because of the political history of that. You know, we've been trying to get a data breach notification uniform national standard and a data security standard for 20 years now. Because of this, you know, going back to that conversation we had on preemption, everyone goes back to their corners. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to the breach notification between retail mm-hmm. and cloud providers mm-hmm. and banks, pulling that whole component on top of this already very complex mm-hmm. privacy debate, I think, has the potential to pull the whole thing down.
That's right. That's right. Well, and does that mean that, and kind of going back to my first question, and again, in about 6 minutes, I'll go to questions. Does that mean that all of these new areas, and I kind of go back to the same question I started with, it's just going to make it much more difficult to get to consensus? Or, and this is my, you know, rock and roll question here, are there three areas, if you were to able to go to legislators and say, stop worrying about these 10 different things and focus on three? And I'll give an example. So 6 months ago, no one was talking about online bias and discrimination. Many of you follow my work, know that really is something important to me. Now we're actually getting legislators to say it can be involved in privacy legislation, but maybe it's not as extensive. We can actually follow up when we get into broader AI implications on that. But at least, you know, one of the things I've been putting out there is update the non-discrimination laws and place those three sentences around that in privacy legislation and move on, right? Not sure if it's going to happen, but it's something I publicly have said. Three things that may get us closer to legislation. Amy? I know there's a lot of conversations. This almost sounds like my dining room table.
Actually, I'm going to take the opportunity to think a little bit more by making one point, because a lot of you guys are privacy people in the room and not security people. And encryption was said. And just an FYI, like, encryption is not always the same. Yeah. There are different forms,
different levels,
strengths, levels. So the writing, like, if data is encrypted, none of this has to take place as a safe harbor, not all created equal. So I'll use that as an education.
Get that
moment.
Out of the system.
So three things. I actually think looking at the beyond consent, looking to think reasons to process data, mm-hmm. The legal basis for processing data is a big thing to get to, because it's cross areas, mm-hmm. And it's something to really dig into that can go beyond sectors. What are the things that we need to provide as legal bases? And what is too broad? Because I think if you talk to the privacy people in Europe, the legitimate basis is like a cop-out and was a huge backdoor to needing a legal basis to get information. And if you talk to the other side, they're like, this is way too narrow and we need a lot more of a reason. And that was another big schism. And so digging into that area, I think, is huge. The Lawyers Committee has a civil rights-based privacy law that uses the different privacy rights and then incorporates civil rights protections. I think looking at that in greater depth is going to be super important. To Nicole's point, I think that's something I care about really deeply as well, and getting those protections in is going to be important. And then getting beyond the exceptions piece. So rather than like a thing that we need to concentrate on, it's getting past needing to have an exception for every single industry or non-industry or sector or size of a company. And as opposed to that, getting to a place where we have a law that doesn't need 50,000 exceptions and is workable and will protect people's privacy into the future when more and more data is going to be collected. I think that the argument about exceptions in the California law went right up to the 11th hour about how many people wanted things, and even now still they're trying to go back and get more written in.
Right, yeah, yeah. Morgan?
I think what Amy said about the exceptions is really interesting and something that we've definitely pushed back on. You'd expect the small business people to say, we need a small business exception. But that's proven to be very risky, and I think you're right. So one of the things that was really telling is at a Senate hearing about the GDPR, they had Google and Apple and Facebook at the hearing, and they asked each of them, how much time did you spend to comply? And I think Google said hundreds of person years of legal time to comply. And the other companies all followed suit. And there was another panel where Garmin, which is actually a pretty small company, they said they spent hundreds of person months on compliance for a company the size of Garmin.
Right.
And so I think Amy's right. Making sure that it's not a bill filled with exceptions, because my community actually deals with large data sets where it doesn't matter how many employees they have, I think you have to have a bill that deals with the size and scope and impact of the data set as much as the size of the company. Mm. I think that's going to be something we've got to deal with to right-size it. I think the second part, you said three, the second part is, and this is a bit blasphemous, and I know I don't have full support for this, but I think most everybody here knows that HIPAA is not actually a privacy law. The P in HIPAA stands for portability, not privacy.
And there's one P.
Yeah, it's one P.
It's one P.
One P. Just portability.
Right.
It is about, and here's a funny little anecdote on this. Unless your doctor actually files electronic insurance electronics insurance claims, technically HIPAA doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Like concierge doctors who never file electronic insurance claims theoretically aren't actually covered. I mean, it's an absurdist treatment of it, but it tells you something about the fact that High Tech Act and the changes to HIPAA are really a tail wagging the dog, because HIPAA was about providing portability for patients and getting access to. And if you meet with ONC, they'll talk about how do we utilize this law to provide better interoperability between EHRs, all that kind of stuff. So when I look at HIPAA, I want to back to this cross-sectoral, do we have an umbrella? I don't know that we want a law that guts HIPAA. I don't think I could ever get that passed. But I think Amy's onto something when you say that it needs to kind of not deal with 5,000 did you say 50,000 exceptions?
I don't remember. 99,000
exceptions?
78.
I think she's right.
Yeah, right.
78,000.
Pick a number, right.
Pick a number.
Exactly.
I think we have to find a way to be true to what the person is looking for, which is some sense of what's happening with their data, that they have some recourse if the data is misused or used in a way they didn't intend, that they have some ability to be engaged in how their data is used, but ultimately that it still provides companies some perspective and leeway to, if I de-identify it, if I aggregate it, that I can still make use of it without that thread being pulled and then my entire algorithm falling apart.
Yeah.
So I think those are two. I think she's right. It has to be sized for all. No tons of exceptions. And watch out for financial or healthcare, where we may be misusing existing laws in a way that prevents it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, just on that, because those have been the use cases that have sort of been triggered,
yep.
right? versus the other one. So that's an interesting way to look at it.
I think we're actually going to get privacy legislation.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're talking. This is Congress, okay?
We need to see something to react to.
What three things can we actually give Congress? This is Congress.
Yes. Give us something to react to. A draft would be really helpful, even if it's a discussion draft. Give us something that we can actually get people to the table. Because, you know, I think all sides of this debate are interested in having this conversation. I mean, industry for sure. Like, we're ready. We want to move something forward. Like, we see the train coming across the country from different states on, you know, what they're going to do on their own if Congress doesn't do something. So let's go. But, you know, barring that, I think it's going to take time. Yeah. And time, one, just because of the nature of the congressional schedule and then it being an election year. And also time to see the implementation of California and react to that. And then time to see how other states try and fill the gap. And then I'm so curious to see where we're going to be in 2 years, how many other states have something and how much they conflict or build on, or if, you know, do they all just build right on top of the California model? Do they take the same? There's a lot of unknowns out there, and I think in 2 years we could be in a very different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it sort of reminds me, and now we're going to go to Q&A, but last night I made a really good macaroni and cheese.
Mm. How many
and
cheeses
when you
did
make
you
macaroni and cheese, you put in the pasta, you put in the egg, you put in the milk, you put in the cheese.
Cheeses,
right? Because you got to have the sharp cheddar baked in and then the shredded on the top. That's how I make it. And the end result is it's either good or it's bad based on how long you cook it. I had to bring it up because my daughter ate about 3 helpings of this. But when I think about this debate, I think about that macaroni and cheese I made last night, because it just seems to me that we all have the right recipe, but we don't have the right actors around the table and the right issues and the right temperature. Maybe that's the congressional climate to actually get stuff done. And my fear is, and the reason I asked a security question, and again, tee up your questions, I think consumers are also somewhat getting it conflated, particularly as this election comes through, in terms of what their privacy means in terms of the public domain of voting and other things. And I think we got to get it straight before, you know, we get into a place where we get into the next stage of issues, which we have not even yet determined what they are. So we're going to take some Q&A. Raise your hand if you have a question. I'd say just identify yourself and keep your question to a question so I can take as many as possible. So we'll start on this side of the room. And we've got some generous time for Q&A, so if you do have a burning question for the panel, please ask.
Hi, my name is Deborah Ray. I'm a graduate student at the University of Maryland. And I'd like to know more about what is being said in the conversation about 2 points. So the first point is not just private right to action, but private incentive to act. Because, you know, just the way the legal framework is set up, you know, it's not enough to just have the right to take somebody to court. You need to be able to go after punitive damages. You need to be able to minimize the, risk of, you know, walking away with nothing at the end of it. So we do need that private incentive to act, especially, I mean, our Constitution is basically a symbol because it is too difficult to actually enforce our rights. And even if we did, it is too difficult to go after damages and hold the government accountable. So the other point that I'd like to know more about is infrastructure as a service. Mm. My understanding is that companies may begin to start sharing data amongst each other, common data. And just the fact that another company owns the data is information as itself. You were saying before that 2 location pieces is enough to identify someone. Mm-hmm. 2 locations where data exists, that could be enough to, come back and gain too much insight into the person. So I just want to know what you have to say about those.
Who would like to take this question?
One thing. You used the term too much. Information. I think I personally prefer the idea of unexpected, because what we keep running into is those of us who are privacy nags have a tendency to be like, you shouldn't do this and you don't do this. But then when you watch consumer behavior and consumer expectations, it's it's actually they're like, no, I want this, or I need this, or I don't want it to. I don't want a lot of friction in the system. COPPA, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, has a ton of friction. Parents don't like it. It's hard to get verifiable parental consent. So what you're really looking for is instead of too much, but is it unexpected? I think there's a point there. On the first point, and I'd like you to take it because this is your space, but I think punitive damages for general non-malfeasance is going to be hard. If you don't have intent, I can't imagine that.
No, and I'm not a lawyer, so I won't jump too far down that rabbit hole. But I actually wanted to go to your second point first, which is I see this assumption of harm in your question. And there are a lot of data points. Ride-sharing, for example, we're seeing a lot of requests from city and local governments for the data that ride-sharing companies have that can be used by the city then to improve services. So I want to challenge a little bit that assumption that because there is a lot of data or because there are a certain number of data points that it's going to be used against someone. I think that it's important to have guardrails on how you use that data and how a city uses that data, how that data is shared. But I don't like the assumption that it's just because there's a lot of it, it's bad, because there's a lot of positive uses there. So I think the use and intent there is really important. Private right of action, that's one of the two, like we started with earlier, those two topics that I think are going to be, those are the hardest to solve for in this debate in Congress. And this is one where everyone's going to be in their corners until we get to that last point of, like, we're down to this last issue of whether or not we're going to get a bill and where do we end up on that? And I think that it probably is going to go more toward the middle than further to the left.
I just want to underscore, I think, the importance of your first point, especially for certain communities. I apologize if what I'm about to discuss makes people uncomfortable. I feel like I need to say that. I did a lot of work a few years ago on the security implications of internet-connected adult intimate devices. And they are collecting, it's an industry collecting more and more information, and it was a weird place where potential victims of these devices getting hacked were getting shame, victim blamed on two sides. You didn't have enough security, and also you used this device to begin with, and how dare you? Right. For certain communities, the information that's being collected and the potential for them to be pigeonholed or shamed is quite great. And that's why a lot of people, I think, want to have a private right of action built in and to have some of those incentives for them to come forth and file challenges, because the potential negative pieces of having themselves involved in these conversations are quite great for those communities. And that's where that importance really comes from. And so just to underscore that and to really pull it out of what tends to be a fairly privileged conversation in Washington, D.C., to say there are other people involved as well who have very, very different threat models that they're facing.
That's right. Thank you. Let's go to second question right over here. And then I'll work this room, and then I'll come on this side, okay?
Great. Jill DeGraff from Aperture Law Group. I am curious if in the health data sector we could actually, a way I think about it is whether the great privacy complex will actually agree not to have a comprehensive bill in favor of something that's just focused on health data outside of HIPAA. And one reason I think about that is that we did have bipartisan support for passage of the 21st Cures Act, which in turn was promoting data interoperability. We're now facing a challenge where there has to be data that will be flowing freely portability-wise to consumers, but into the great unknown of third-party apps. And so there is some urgency, and I just wonder whether you think we could peel that off and iterate on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gordon? We know that ONC, and I'm sure given where you work, you know this, I mean, ONC has been kind of raising these questions. It's not a notice of proposed rulemaking. I'm forgetting the ONC version of this, where they've asked for input on that exact question. Yeah, it's a notice of inquiry. Thank you. Oh, there's too many acronyms in this town. So there is a notice of inquiry on that exact question on how do we do portability post-21st century cures, and that was she's exactly right. That was part of what was kind of tried to be teased out. I think the problem that we keep finding, and I mentioned this earlier, is what is health data, right? When you start to move into clinical decision support software, that's a an FDA-ish term, right, around data sets that actually provide decisions for physicians. When you're starting to gather a lot of these data, you may have data in there that might not be traditionally covered. And so this question of, does data that goes into your EHR, you know, traditionally we just say, oh, well, if it goes to a covered entity, then it's data that's covered by HIPAA. But what if I'm taking data sets from an EHR that are provided by a covered entity, and then I'm overlaying it with data sets that I've purchased from, say, Giant, right? And I want location data overlaid on it to see if there's a nutritional deficit there, or is there something else in the environment that's causing it? I think the hard part with a standalone data to try to help interoperability will be, I don't remember if it was Amy or who said it, if it was you, talked about the definitions aspect.
Yep.
I think the hard part in that fight is going to be about defining what is health data,
right?
Because there are going to be things that sound like edge cases that aren't so edge case that are going to make this harder to define. But it's a great question, and it is something that I know everybody's trying to figure out. How do we get that portability and interoperability in an environment where HIPAA may actually impede?
Right. And just on that health data question, moderator privilege, it is interesting, too, because it's health data defined by diagnosis or, you know, treatment versus health data like my apps that help me manage my calories that I think are keeping me, you know, more fluid health data,
right,
quote unquote, that could actually be implicated, I think, in any privacy legislation. I think is one of the areas.
That's right.
And if I can just jump in on that as well. So CTA, we have actually have a lot of health and wellness members, device makers and app makers.
Right.
We actually recently just put out a health and fitness privacy guidelines for our member companies that, you know, our members came together to say, you know, to explain, you know, what the expectations are for that data that's in the in-between that is not HIPAA data that is,
right,
you know. So I think there's obviously action in the industry to address that issue because there are definitely consumer concerns and questions around that. But when it comes to actual legislation, I don't think splitting out pieces,
right,
is where this will go, because once you start pulling it off, then the next person wants their issue pulled out, and the next one,
services,
and the whole thing falls apart. So I think it's all or nothing, yeah, at this point.
Okay, next question. Okay, I'll take one question from here, and then I'll take one question from here. I'm going to move over here. So this young man next. So we have another mic right over here. This gentleman, raise your hand just so we can get the mic near you. Okay, perfect.
Hi, Alyssa Haslett with the Cohen Group. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the potential impacts of privacy laws on the on companies operating in the transportation sector, so specifically autonomous vehicles and connected car services.
Mm-hmm. Yay, my favorite topic. So, no, I do a lot of work on self-driving. So, and this is one area where I've actually been very focused and very interested to see how the privacy side of the debate and the self-driving side come together. And one point that came up when I was raising this with my members working in this space is facial recognition technology. Mm-hmm. So there was earlier this year, Senators Blunt and Schatz had a draft facial mm-hmm. recognition bill that they were floating around. And as I was gathering feedback from my members, I had a couple different vehicle tech members say, this could have a really negative impact on future uses for self-driving vehicles, and from two different aspects. One, from the vision of the vehicle and mm-hmm. recognizing people versus animals or a tree trunk or whatever mm-hmm. else is out there. But two, if we're thinking about self-driving as a, you know, being the basis for future ride sharing, if you're going and you're getting in your self-driving Uber, there's no one in it to identify that it's you that should be getting in the vehicle. I would imagine, and a lot of my company is just thinking about, you know, how do we use, mm-hmm. do we use facial recognition technology to acknowledge that, yes, the right person is getting in the right car and going to the right place, which is going to be very important,
yeah,
when there's no one, there's no driver.
That's right.
So if you're the user and that's your Uber, you're fine. You've already consented. You know, you have the information and disclosures of how the information is being used. How does it impact someone that it's not their Uber and they go up and they just, you know, want to take a look in and be like, oh, what's this? And they haven't consented. You know, can can the Uber even scan your face to check if you haven't opted in? What are the consent mechanisms there, and what are the disclosure mechanisms there? So there's definitely going to be some interesting edge cases like that as well. And you could do this for any sector across the economy. When you pick something like that, you're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that before, mm-hmm. where there's just going to be these kind of weird questions looking into the future.
And you want to add on the facial
right? I have an interesting story, actually. About 5 years ago, I was at a conference, and I can't say, it was under a certain rule, so I can't talk about the identification, but somebody from a car company was saying, well, we collect this data and this data and this data and this data, and somebody asked if they could have like a private driving mode, much like you have a private mm-hmm. browser mode, where the driver could opt to turn off all of those different types of data collection. And the person from the company was clearly appalled, and they were like, how could you turn off this data collection? It's not safe to drive without it. Mm-hmm. And somebody at my table with me, because it's a room of privacy people, looks at me and was like, how did we drive for the last several centuries?
Right.
And I think like there is a potential for tech to enter in and do things, but we need to also think back to the fact that we've done this for a really long time. Right. What data do we need to collect? Like, what is the data that is absolutely necessary to collect in order to operate a driverless vehicle? Versus what is the optional stuff that we're adding on top of that, like facial recognition, where you could really enter a code to get into the door, much like people did with Zipcar since Zipcar was created. People may want that extra facial recognition. Like, some people may want to look at their phone and have it unlocked, but other people might not. Where are the optional data categories?
Well, if I can, I'll just, because we're doing a lot of work on AI and facial rec. The other thing I would think that is also coming to the privacy legislation, this kind of goes back to my earlier point about how strong is the umbrella to withstand the storms of innovation. Because if you look at facial recognition as it's being debated outside of privacy, there's a call to ban it. And if that call to ban it happens, then what does that look like when it comes to privacy legislation? Or are you really talking about maybe data minimization because the faces that are being collected may be faces that are not accurate or technically there are still some problems. So the latest case that I heard of facial recognition autonomous vehicles, I hate to crack a little thing about this, but I think it's sort of what we've been talking about all day, is because the technology is flawed in recognizing darker skin hues, the likelihood of African Americans to be hit by that autonomous vehicle is as likely as hitting a tree trunk, because the technology is not refined. Mm-hmm. And so again, this goes back to all of these different areas of technology that are being overlaid and created in the midst of the discussion on legislation, and how deep do we go, right, before we actually come up with something that we can live with that won't implode other parts of the economy? Or are those conversations happening marginal to this that will find themselves in privacy legislation? You all following me? This is like a continuous flow of conversation, which is why we're still talking about it. All right, that was my little moderator soapbox. I want to open it up for more questions. Let's go to this gentleman, and we'll take one more question on this side, and then we'll wrap up.
Hey, Dan Murphy from the Financial Health Network.
Put it closer. Okay. Yeah.
Dan Murphy from the Financial Health Network.
Perfect.
So I was a little surprised to hear you guys say that you don't think that this is going to break down a little bit more along verticals, because it seems to me that's where a lot of the action actually is happening already. So, Morgan, you alluded to the idea that all data sort of can be health data. In the financial data ecosystem, all data similarly can be credit data at the same time. Yep. And we have a lot of laws around that, FCRA, ACOA. And those conversations are happening in terms of, okay, what type of data is credit data? And so I'm just kind of curious, what industries do you guys see as being ahead? And why is it that you don't think that that action is going to happen before a national privacy law comes to fruition?
Because you kind of pointed to it. With FCRA and a lot of these, if you look at how they're structured, a lot of them are harms-based, right? It has to do with the action of fair credit, has to do with the impact that it has on the person in their ability to get a loan or get a house. I mean, almost all of those laws have a harms theory. And as we heard from the question over here and from her point about communities that are different, that may have different needs and where the harm might be something that isn't monetary, I think it makes it really hard to do that. Health data is a good example. One of the areas that has been fascinating to work with on the health community, we had a bunch of roundtables around this. Some patient advocacy groups are okay with privacy, but some of the fiercest advocates for not having privacy legislation are people whose children or family members have a disease that doesn't have a cure or a good treatment. Those people come to the table and basically say, I don't care about your privacy. My child is dying. I need this. I need more information. They are zealous advocates for data because they have a family member that's dying. Mm-hmm. And they are insulted when you say, how dare you do this? So don't forget that there are people for whom they see, I don't think that, you know, it's quite the same, but there's a problem with how that will all work. Because those people will come to the table and say, if we have this narrow confine and this narrow construct around health data, what is its impact on orphan diseases or diseases that don't have good treatment mechanisms? That, by the way, was back to the problem with this. We all talk amongst ourselves, but until I sat down with privacy groups, with patient advocacy groups, that's when I got kind of cold-cocked by, I'd been in my own privileged, healthy bubble with everything working, and I'd never thought about the implications for people in that case. So I think it's hard because you'll be surprised where some of the folks will come from. And to your first question, most of the financial privacy space is dominated by harm. Does it hurt someone? And I think that's, it'll be hard to put that into the same context on health. Or if we do, it'll be interesting to see how we, because her point about private right of action, how do we monetize it? How do you seek monetary damages for that?
Right.
Maybe we'll get it done, but that's why I think it'll be a little harder.
Jamie?
Yeah, and I just want to clarify when I said earlier that I don't think like health will be split off to be its own separate piece. I was speaking specifically to legislation on the Hill. I think in a lot of those verticals you just mentioned and others, there is a lot of work already going on and that will continue to go on the regulatory side,
yes,
or on the industry,
right,
side,
yes, she's right,
you know, industry consensus sides,
right,
and guidelines and standards. Those things will absolutely happen and continue to happen. I just don't think that Congress will start to split apart privacy, right, into different verticals as opposed to a comprehensive privacy.
I mean, ultimately, this conversation is happening for like a handful of reasons, and one of them is the words that Nicole said at the beginning, Cambridge Analytica. And if we don't get a solution that solves all the way back for that and we stick in the verticals, I think people are going to see that we haven't done what we set out to do. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're going to continue on the comprehensive track. There are so many entities. Everything,
right,
is tech. Are we solving for the problems when we re-narrow this back down? And I think we need to be having this
right,
nuanced conversation about things outside of social media, because that has dominated the conversation.
Right.
But the solution is going to have to solve for that.
Right. It's going to go back to that. Okay, there was another question over here. Did I see one more question? Hand? Did I see a hand? Okay, final question, and then we'll wrap up.
A lot of pressure. I am Kristen Collins. I'm a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. I think this is kind of goes to what you were just touching on. Morgan used the language of markets when you were discussing data and the idea of consumers knowing the value, mm-hmm, of their data in the market. And I wonder what the ethical and political advantages and disadvantages are of using that framework, especially when we think about the collective implications and the ways in which privacy is tied to things like disinformation or security, and whether or not framing data in that way will allow us to think more in a more integrated manner of these different implications. So the idea of, you know, if we focus on the individual and their consent to their privacy in this exchange, will we be able to get at these bigger questions that are tied into privacy, or will it limit our focus?
Mm-hmm. Mm, interesting. Okay, why don't we go down the line?
So I spoke about this last time I was on this stage,
right,
where I actually think this is a really bad road to walk down. Once you start getting into how much is your data worth, you,
yeah,
start getting into how much can we pay you for your data, and that's a super predatory business model, actually, where you start saying, can we take advantage of certain marginalized communities,
yeah,
in order to give them money for them to give up large amounts of their information? And then privacy becomes a privileged commodity reserved for those who can afford it. So I would prefer we stay away from that framing and start to think of it more as a series of rights, the way the GDPR and CCPA both framed it.
You know, you want to say something different. It's okay.
No,
you agree,
no,
with Amy the whole time. It's okay to disagree.
Well, I'll jump in if you're still thinking.
I want to think about how to frame up.
Yeah, I think Amy has a good point there. And I think from the other side of it, from the innovation side of it, you have the potential then to restrict innovation to only those that can afford to pay for the data. And that is not good for anybody. That's not good for our consumers, and it's not good for all of the potential entrepreneurs and innovators out there. So I think I agree with Amy. It's a really risky path to walk down.
I guess this is the hard part. I mean, it's a good question, and it's I may not have a crisp answer. Here's the thing. One of the most interesting, and having worked with Nicole on this, one of the most interesting aspects of smartphones has been the rapid adoption of this technology in communities that are have been underserved by tech.
Right.
Smartphone is the fastest adopted technology in the history of mankind, by far. Faster than the wheel, faster than fire, faster than the microwave,
faster
which was a close
fire.
Second. By far, yeah. Like, by every evidence about where you see, like, how quickly it moved around. I mean, you know, when you talk about marginal communities and impacted, you have folks in Bangladesh who do not have running water, do not have a street, are on dirt, and yet they use a smartphone to check commodities pricing before they go fishing so that they can make sure that they get the highest price by going to the next, to the right town. And while that's, you know, not in America, you see the same thing going on. Mm-hmm. In the Mississippi Delta, University of Mississippi Medical Center is working to deal with type 2 diabetes in a community where they're more than 2 hours away from a healthcare professional. Because guess what? Mm-hmm. That's a community that's poor and doesn't have a long enough education, but they've all got smartphones and they've all got data plans that allow them to have a lot of data access. So I want to be careful to not be quite as quick as Amy was on making this determination, because I think that a lot of those communities actually see value. And I'll give you an example. A lot of employers are now putting their job applications on mobile devices, especially ones that go to jobs that don't require college. And they're doing that because they find the people who will apply have a smartphone. They don't have a personal computer with a printer, but they do have a smartphone. And so before we jump to, oh, well, those people can't possibly make good decisions, I want to be careful with that. And I understand your point about using the value framework, but I don't think that I, as a white guy, should tell people who aren't like me how they should make determinations. And I want to be very careful of not being too...
So I help
diminishing.
You. I help you because I'm a black woman.
That's right.
I don't want my data bought and sold. And I'm going to tell you why. I think, so Mark, I think you outnumbered on this one.
It's fine. I'll lose it. As I said, I'm trying to be careful.
But I'll give you a little bit of credit on something. So I think the question, and I'll wrap it up with this. I think the question is well-intentioned, right? Because I think at the end of the day, the fundamental framework around any of these privacy conversations around the good stewardship on both the receiver and the recipient in this ecology, right? I want to know that when I give my data, it's done for good purpose, much like when we go to a bank and we give our money to the teller, we want to know that it's going into the vault and not into their pocket, right? But when you talk about the valuation of data, particularly among disparate groups or different types of people, you do run the risk of exploitation. And it already happens. I mean, Henrietta Lacks, who some of you know about, gave up her information for a long time, helped to solve a lot of curable diseases and was never paid for it and died an indigent. And that's partly because we don't have in the society, kind of goes back to what Amy said, the values that operate on the principle that all data is created equal. And we don't have a system, which is why we're talking about privacy legislation, that not only is all data created equal, but in some respects, all data carries a currency that is valuable to the person and not something that should be used and exploited and manipulated for other purposes. And that's why I would leave it, Morgan. I think that even though people are on smartphones and even though for health reasons they should be paid 10 cents for a blood pressure prick in their arm, doesn't mean that we want them walking around with 10,000 pricks in their arm just because somebody took advantage of them because they were going to be paid 50 cents. Not having food is being hungry. Right. And that's another issue that should not be solved by our ability to evaluate people's data. There's no currency in that. So with that, you can see why this is a difficult conversation to have, but one that we need to have, right? I want to thank the panelists and give them a round of applause. I I hope that all of you take away from this that this is not the last privacy panel that you're going to go to. And I also hope that you take away from this that the issues, again, of the umbrella that we're dealing with have many spokes, and we will soon get there. And let's thank Amy for coming all the way from Boulder to revisit us back here. Thank you again, everybody.